University of Cambridge International Examinations. International General Certificate of Secondary Education. June Examination Session 2011. English as a Second Language. Extended Tier. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, centre number and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the recording to be louder or quieter, tell your teacher now. The recording will not be stopped while you are doing the test. Teacher, please give out the question papers, and when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the recording back on. Now you are all ready, here is the test. Look at questions 1 to 6. For each question, you will hear the situation described as it is on your exam paper. You will hear each item twice. Questions 1 to 6. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answers should be as brief as possible. You will hear each item twice. Question 1. Why are the train journeys taking longer today?
A return ticket to Martinstown, please.
All mainline trains are using a different route today. We've got ice on the line here in our area.
Will it take me longer to get there?
Allow at least an extra hour for your journey time today.
A return ticket to Martinstown, please.
All mainline trains are using a different route today. We've got ice on the line here in our area.
Will it take me longer to get there?
Allow at least an extra hour for your journey time today.
Question 2. Why hasn't Zeb done his homework on time? Give 2 details.
Zeb, where's your homework, please?
I'm sorry, Mrs. Ranzani. I haven't had time to complete it because I had band practice straight after school yesterday and the concert all evening.
OK, Zeb. I accept your excuse. Zeb, where's your homework, please?
I'm sorry, Mrs. Ranzani. I haven't had time to complete it because I had band practice straight after school yesterday and the concert all evening.
OK, Zeb. I accept your excuse.
Question 3. Which delivery service is chosen and why?
Good morning. This parcel needs to arrive tomorrow. It's my friend's birthday.
OK, you can use next day delivery. That will cost £4.70 and will arrive tomorrow.
The trouble is, I think he'll be out for most of the day.
We can offer you express delivery. It costs £6.40 and is guaranteed to arrive before 8 a.m.
Good. I'll take that one. Then the parcel will arrive before he goes out. Good morning. This parcel needs to arrive tomorrow. It's my friend's birthday.
OK, you can use next day delivery. That will cost £4.70 and will arrive tomorrow.
The trouble is, I think he'll be out for most of the day.
We can offer you express delivery. It costs £6.40 and is guaranteed to arrive before 8 a.m.
Good. I'll take that one. Then the parcel will arrive before he goes out.
Question 4. Why does the speaker wish to change the dental appointment?
Hello, is that Mr. Peters? I have an appointment for a dental check-up with you tomorrow, but I have to stay late at school.
OK, I can see you early in the day. Be here for 8 a.m.
Hello, is that Mr. Peters? I have an appointment for a dental check-up with you tomorrow, but I have to stay late at school.
OK, I can see you early in the day. Be here for 8 a.m.
Question 5. What makes the ticket offer a good deal?
Hello, Alessandra. I have 15 tickets to that new show in the Town Theatre for Tuesday night's 7 p.m. performance. Would you like to come?
I can't go on Tuesday, but I know my sister would like to go. How much is each ticket?
£10 originally, but I negotiated a group discount of 10%, so £9.
Hello, Alessandra. I have 15 tickets to that new show in the Town Theatre for Tuesday night's 7 p.m. performance. Would you like to come?
I can't go on Tuesday, but I know my sister would like to go. How much is each ticket?
£10 originally, but I negotiated a group discount of 10%, so £9.
Question 6. Which two immediate solutions are mentioned?
Mum, the computer isn't working and it's the weekend. The repair shop will be shut.
You'll have to write your homework by hand instead then. We'll take the computer to the repairers when the shop is open next week.
But Mum, I know my friend Andreu can mend computers. I'll phone him and ask him to come and have a look at it straight away. Mum, the computer isn't working and it's the weekend. The repair shop will be shut.
You'll have to write your homework by hand instead then. We'll take the computer to the repairers when the shop is open next week.
But Mum, I know my friend Andreu can mend computers. I'll phone him and ask him to come and have a look at it straight away.
That is the last of questions 1 to 6. In a moment, you will hear question 7. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 7. Listen to the following interview with an orchard keeper and then complete the details below. You will hear the interview twice.
Good evening and welcome to our careers series. Tonight, Corn Zhang is here in the studio to discuss with us his working life. Corn, please tell us about your job.
Thank you. I have a wonderful job. I'm out in the open air, helping to look after nature and people all at once.
That sounds very fulfilling. What is your job then?
I look after orchards. You know, fields and fields of trees, specially planted for their fruit.
All sorts of fruit trees?
Yes, and also nut trees.
OK, so you look after trees. Are you responsible for seeing the fruit through to harvest until it's sold and eaten?
Yes, but my role doesn't stop there. Think of all the wildlife which depends on trees. Bats, owls, beetles, all sorts of insects.
What about bees?
Yes, of course. There are beehives in most of the orchards where I work. Bees help to pollinate the trees and produce wonderful honey. Bees are actually under threat of extinction at the moment, so beekeeping is a really worthwhile activity.
And are there any other animals involved in your job?
Yes, we keep pigs in orchards too. They eat up fallen acorns for us. Often ducks and other wild birds also set up home there on the ponds and streams.
Any more?
The floor has carpets of mushrooms, toadstools and other fungi. Wild grass snakes live there. Every part of the orchard is used by nature.
I've never heard of orchard keeping as a job. I assumed the orchards looked after themselves until fruit picking time.
Oh no, it's not that simple.
So, how did you get the job?
Well, I'm from Malaysia. I did a degree in ecology, then worked for a while as an assistant to get some fieldwork experience.
And after that?
Then I answered an advertisement for a 2-year post. It was to work on orchard preservation and development and funded by a wildlife trust. And here I am.
Is your job very lonely? Just you and the trees?
No. Part of my role is to develop and plant what we call community orchards, where the whole area is involved and receives the benefits of the fruit.
There is one here in the local village.
When setting up a new orchard, I show people how to plant and care for new trees. Then, when the funds which pay for my job come to an end, local people will be able to maintain their own orchards as a result of my support.
Thank you, and good luck with all your projects.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Good evening and welcome to our careers series. Tonight, Corn Zhang is here in the studio to discuss with us his working life. Corn, please tell us about your job.
Thank you. I have a wonderful job. I'm out in the open air, helping to look after nature and people all at once.
That sounds very fulfilling. What is your job then?
I look after orchards. You know, fields and fields of trees, specially planted for their fruit.
All sorts of fruit trees?
Yes, and also nut trees.
Okay, so you look after trees. Are you responsible for seeing the fruit through to harvest until it's sold and eaten?
Yes, but my role doesn't stop there. Think of all the wildlife which depends on trees. Bats, owls, beetles, all sorts of insects.
What about bees?
Yes, of course. There are beehives in most of the orchards where I work. Bees help to pollinate the trees and produce wonderful honey. Bees are actually under threat of extinction at the moment, so beekeeping is a really worthwhile activity.
And are there any other animals involved in your job?
Yes, we keep pigs in orchards too. They eat up fallen acorns for us. Often ducks and other wild birds also set up home there on the ponds and streams.
Any more?
The floor has carpets of mushrooms, toadstools and other fungi. Wild grass snakes live there. Every part of the orchard is used by nature.
I've never heard of orchard keeping as a job. I assumed the orchards looked after themselves until fruit picking time.
Oh no, it's not that simple.
So, how did you get the job?
Well, I'm from Malaysia. I did a degree in ecology, then worked for a while as an assistant to get some fieldwork experience.
And after that?
Then I answered an advertisement for a 2-year post. It was to work on orchard preservation and development and funded by a wildlife trust. And here I am.
Is your job very lonely? Just you and the trees?
No. Part of my role is to develop and plant what we call community orchards, where the whole area is involved and receives the benefits of the fruit.
There is one here in the local village.
When setting up a new orchard, I show people how to plant and care for new trees. Then, when the funds which pay for my job come to an end, local people will be able to maintain their own orchards as a result of my support.
Thank you, and good luck with all your projects.
That is the end of question 7. In a moment, you will hear question 8. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 8. Listen to the following interview with the inventor of a record-breaking car powered by steam, and then complete the following details. You will hear the interview twice.
Hello, and welcome to Sports Weekly. Today, Charles Burnett is going to tell us about his unusual speed record-breaking car.
Thank you. Yes, my car broke the land speed record for steam-powered cars. The record was set in 1906. My car is unusual because it doesn't run on petrol. It's powered by steam.
Do you mean it runs like an old-fashioned train?
Yes. The car is 8 metres long and weighs 3 tonnes. It runs like a kettle on wheels.
Is it made of metal?
Yes. The body of the car is made of a steel frame which is covered with sheets of blended carbon and aluminium.
And how is it powered?
By 12 boilers and nearly 3 kilometres of tubing to connect everything together.
Are you an engineer?
No, I'm a businessman and a driver. I had the original idea and I recruited a team of engineers to build the steam car for me to drive and break the record.
Tell us how you broke the land speed record.
A driver called Fred Marriott set the previous record of 204 kilometres per hour. To beat that, we had to finish 2 runs in the car in opposite directions, less than an hour apart, just as Fred had done in 1906.
And how is the record worked out?
The average of the two speeds goes towards achieving the record, which then has to be recognised by the International Federation of Automobiles.
Where were you able to drive so fast? On a beach somewhere, perhaps?
For practice sessions, we did use beaches, but the winning record attempt was in a desert in California. We had had a previous try at the record, but sand had got in the engine.
So how fast did you go in the end?
On the first run, the speed was just over 219 kilometres per hour. And on the return run, it reached more than 243 kilometres per hour. Our new record is the average speed of the 2 runs, 231 kilometres per hour.
Were you nervous?
I was, a little. But the car handled beautifully, and I'm used to driving our steam car.
What would you say was the secret of your success?
My crew, of course. Good engineers, good teamwork, and much perseverance.
Is the car still in one piece?
Oh, yes. It's famous, and we're touring the world with it. We use it to raise money for charities by exhibiting it. Eventually, it will come to rest in a museum for old and famous cars.
Thank you. We'll look out for you and the car.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Hello, and welcome to Sports Weekly. Today, Charles Burnett is going to tell us about his unusual speed record-breaking car.
Thank you. Yes, my car broke the land speed record for steam-powered cars. The record was set in 1906. My car is unusual because it doesn't run on petrol. It's powered by steam.
Do you mean it runs like an old-fashioned train?
Yes. The car is 8 metres long and weighs 3 tonnes. It runs like a kettle on wheels.
Is it made of metal?
Yes. The body of the car is made of a steel frame which is covered with sheets of blended carbon and aluminium.
Hmm. And how is it powered?
By 12 boilers and nearly 3 kilometres of tubing to connect everything together.
Are you an engineer?
No, I'm a businessman and a driver. I had the original idea and I recruited a team of engineers to build the steam car for me to drive and break the record.
Tell us how you broke the land speed record.
A driver called Fred Marriott set the previous record of 204 kilometres per hour. To beat that, we had to finish 2 runs in the car in opposite directions, less than an hour apart, just as Fred had done in 1906.
And how is the record worked out?
The average of the 2 speeds goes towards achieving the record, which then has to be recognised by the International Federation of Automobiles.
Hmm. Where were you able to drive so fast? On a beach somewhere, perhaps?
For practice sessions, we did use beaches, but the winning record attempt was in a desert in California. We had had a previous try at the record, but sand had got in the engine.
So, how fast did you go in the end?
On the first run, the speed was just over 219 kilometres per hour, and on the return run, it reached more than 243 kilometres per hour. Our new record is the average speed of the 2 runs, 231 kilometres per hour.
Were you nervous?
I was, a little. But the car handled beautifully, and I'm used to driving our steam car.
What would you say was the secret of your success?
My crew, of course. Good engineers, good teamwork, and much perseverance.
Is the car still in one piece?
Oh, yes. It's famous, and we're touring the world with it. We use it to raise money for charities by exhibiting it. Eventually, it will come to rest in a museum for old and famous cars.
Thank you. We'll look out for you and the car.
That is the end of question 8. In a moment, you will hear question 9. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam.
You'll hear a radio report about dolphins. For questions 9 to 18, complete the sentences. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at part 2.
And for our last news item today, a special report from Diane Hassan on an animal that is rapidly becoming known as man's best friend, the dolphin.
Last week, a 28-year-old diver who went swimming in the Red Sea with a group of dolphins learned the hard way just how caring these creatures can be. When the diver was suddenly attacked by a shark, they saved him by forming a circle around him and frightening the shark away. It's not the first time such a rescue has happened, and it's been known for some time that dolphins will do for humans what they do for their own kind. They are, in fact, the only animals in the world whose brains match ours in terms of size, and their intelligence and ability to feel emotion continue to fascinate scientists and doctors alike. For some time now, their healing powers have been well known. A swim with a group of dolphins, for example, is a recognised medical activity for everyday problems such as stress. But some dolphins are playing a far more serious medical role for us than that. Amanda Morton, who suffered from a life-threatening illness, argued that being with dolphins saved her life because they were able to read her feelings. "They knew how I was feeling," she was quoted as saying. And it's the idea that they actually care, that they are gentle, happy creatures that want to befriend us, which has led to projects with children as well. In one such project, dolphins are being used to help children who are slow learners learn to read. The dolphins do things like carrying small boards on their noses. These boards show words or pictures which the children are asked to identify. When the children get it right, they spend more time swimming with the dolphins and touching them, and they see this as a reward. So, what is it that makes contact with dolphins so powerful? They certainly have an engaging smile. In each jaw, they have up to 52 teeth, but rather than frightening us to death, it's one of the warmest greetings in the world. They're also fantastic swimmers to watch. The spotted dolphin has been observed reaching 20 miles an hour and keeping this up for 2 days at a time. And they know they're good at it, so they show off in front of humans by diving in and out of the water and showing us just how much fun they're having. They're great communicators too. They make all kinds of fascinating high-pitched noises. They catch fish, for example, by sending out sound waves, which tell them everything they need to know: where it is, what it is, and how big it is. The only creatures that concern dolphins, in fact, are sharks and man. We don't necessarily harm them on purpose, but we trap them in fishing nets, and we pollute the water they swim in. Pollution, in fact, is one of the dolphins' greatest problems. So, with all the good they do for us, isn't it time we started caring about them?
Now you'll hear part two again.
And for our last news item today, a special report from Diane Hassan on an animal that is rapidly becoming known as man's best friend, the dolphin.
Last week, a 28-year-old diver who went swimming in the Red Sea with a group of dolphins learned the hard way just how caring these creatures can be. When the diver was suddenly attacked by a shark, they saved him by forming a circle around him and frightening the shark away. It's not the first time such a rescue has happened, and it's been known for some time that dolphins will do for humans what they do for their own kind. They are, in fact, the only animals in the world whose brains match ours in terms of size, and their intelligence and ability to feel emotion continue to fascinate scientists and doctors alike. For some time now, their healing powers have been well known. A swim with a group of dolphins, for example, is a recognised medical activity for everyday problems such as stress. But some dolphins are playing a far more serious medical role for us than that. Amanda Morton, who suffered from a life-threatening illness, argued that being with dolphins saved her life because they were able to read her feelings. "They knew how I was feeling," she was quoted as saying. And it's the idea that they actually care, that they are gentle, happy creatures that want to befriend us, which has led to projects with children as well. In one such project, dolphins are being used to help children who are slow learners learn to read. The dolphins do things like carrying small boards on their noses. These boards show words or pictures which the children are asked to identify. When the children get it right, they spend more time swimming with the dolphins and touching them, and they see this as a reward. So, what is it that makes contact with dolphins so powerful? They certainly have an engaging smile. In each jaw, they have up to 52 teeth, but rather than frightening us to death, it's one of the warmest greetings in the world. They're also fantastic swimmers to watch. The spotted dolphin has been observed reaching 20 miles an hour and keeping this up for 2 days at a time. And they know they're good at it, so they show off in front of humans by diving in and out of the water and showing us just how much fun they're having. They're great communicators too. They make all kinds of fascinating high-pitched noises. They catch fish, for example, by sending out sound waves, which tell them everything they need to know: where it is, what it is, and how big it is. The only creatures that concern dolphins, in fact, are sharks and man. We don't necessarily harm them on purpose, but we trap them in fishing nets, and we pollute the water they swim in. Pollution, in fact, is one of the dolphins' greatest problems. So, with all the good they do for us, isn't it time we started caring about them?
That's the end of part two. Now turn to part three. You'll hear five different people talking about the head teacher or principal of their former secondary school. For questions 19 to 23, choose from the list A to F what each speaker is saying. Use the letters only once. There's one extra letter which you do not need to use. You now have 30 seconds in which to look at part three. Speaker 1.
It's strange looking back because at the time you don't always appreciate people. And certainly I think that's true of your teachers, and particularly a head teacher. I mean, she was always encouraging us not to drop litter and to think about things like preserving the countryside and so on. And she'd say, "Don't you want your children to live in a better world?" But when you're 15, you can't imagine having a family. All you care about is getting your homework done and going out with your friends.
Speaker 2.
I don't know if it's the same in all countries, but where I live, your head teacher usually teaches classes too, and we had our head for athletics. In one way, it was exciting, because she was very good at it herself, like she could outrun any of the boys in our class. But whatever we were doing, she was always pushing us to do it faster than anyone else or jump higher than our friends, regardless of the talent or ability we had. And with some, it was pointless.
Speaker 3.
I think if it hadn't been for our head teacher, I'd be doing something quite different now. She used to assess our art exams, and although there were people in my class who were really talented artists, you know, they could paint anything from real life and it looked brilliant, she always preferred the more unusual stuff. She said it showed we had ideas of our own. And she really liked that, so I did well. I mean, now I make a living putting designs on greeting cards.
Speaker 4.
I always felt that our head teacher was undervalued and that she might have done better in a different environment. Her own staff held her up a bit. They all seemed, oh, I don't know, maybe they just didn't like the idea of change. But I remember she wanted to introduce a new teaching method for French classes, and the department head just dismissed the idea. And so many ideas she had which were never taken up are being used in schools today. I sometimes wonder how she feels.
Speaker 5.
I've got some friends who say they left school and they suddenly felt lost. They'd spent a long time getting an education, but didn't know what to do once they'd got it. I think we were lucky, because our head teacher built up a good network of contacts with local people, and so they didn't mind giving us an insight into what it might be like, say, working in a hospital or office. I know it wasn't a new idea or anything, but I think she gave us a good sense of direction, which I valued all my life.
Now you'll hear part 3 again. Speaker 1.
It's strange looking back because at the time you don't always appreciate people. And certainly I think that's true of your teachers, and particularly a head teacher. I mean, she was always encouraging us not to drop litter and to think about things like preserving the countryside and so on. And she'd say, "Don't you want your children to live in a better world?" But when you're 15, you can't imagine having a family. All you care about is getting your homework done and going out with your friends.
Speaker 2.
I don't know if it's the same in all countries, but where I live, your head teacher usually teaches classes too, and we had our head for athletics. In one way, it was exciting, because she was very good at it herself, like she could outrun any of the boys in our class. But whatever we were doing, she was always pushing us to do it faster than anyone else or jump higher than our friends, regardless of the talent or ability we had. And with some, it was pointless.
Speaker 3.
I think if it hadn't been for our head teacher, I'd be doing something quite different now. She used to assess our art exams, and although there were people in my class who were really talented artists, you know, they could paint anything from real life and it looked brilliant, she always preferred the more unusual stuff. She said it showed we had ideas of our own, and she really liked that, so I did well. I mean, now I make a living putting designs on greeting cards.
Speaker 4.
I always felt that our head teacher was undervalued and that she might have done better in a different environment. Her own staff held her up a bit. They all seemed, oh, I don't know, maybe they just didn't like the idea of change. But I remember she wanted to introduce a new teaching method for French classes, and the department head just dismissed the idea. And so many ideas she had which were never taken up are being used in schools today. I sometimes wonder how she feels.
Speaker 5.
I've got some friends who say they left school and they suddenly felt lost. They'd spent a long time getting an education, but didn't know what to do once they'd got it. I think we were lucky, because our head teacher built up a good network of contacts with local people. And so they didn't mind giving us an insight into what it might be like, say, working in a hospital or office. I know it wasn't a new idea or anything, but I think she gave us a good sense of direction, which I valued all my life.
That's the end of part 3. Now turn to part 4. You'll hear an interview with a tour leader who works for an adventure company in Africa. For questions 24 to 30, choose the best answer, A, B or C. You now have 1 minute in which to look at part 4.
And now for the holiday programme with Mandy Rice.
Today I'm talking to Don Nicholson, a tour leader who spends 10 months of the year looking after groups of up to 18 tourists in southern Africa. They travel together in the back of a truck, put up their own tents and cook their own food. Welcome to the programme, Don.
Thanks.
This is a holiday with a difference, isn't it? Tell us, first of all, what sort of people go on a camping trip in Africa? And a long one at that. It is a month each trip.
Yes, well, it sounds a sort of student-y thing to do, but in fact the majority of our passengers are people like doctors and lawyers. We do get some students, but they tend to be the ones that are studying something like conservation or wildlife.
And when do they all first meet?
The evening before we set off. They fly in, and I pick them up from the airport, and immediately before we start sorting out places in the truck, we go through what they've brought with them. Amazingly, every now and then we get somebody who genuinely doesn't realise it's a camping tour, so I have to rush out and get them blankets and a sleeping bag.
It must be difficult. A whole group of strangers coming together, and then having to live together like that.
Well, it goes surprisingly well. But I always think the first day is critical because it sets the tone for the whole trip. We've had the odd nightmare start where we've got a flat tyre 20 minutes after we set off, or it's dark and pouring with rain and people just can't get their tents up. Once we were making pasta late at night and the cook put in a tin of strawberry jam instead of tomato paste. Those are the bad starts.
Basically, everyone has to take part in the domestic chores, do they?
Yes. The brochure makes it clear that people have to work on a rota system, and they usually do about an hour's work a day. We get a few who don't want to muck in, but more often they're just untidy, and I've got a bit of an eye for that because, well, they might leave a fork lying on the ground, for example, and, OK, it's just a fork, but in a lot of places in Africa you can't get forks, so I'm quite possessive about the equipment.
And do people really get on?
Well, a lot of people have never lived in a tight community situation like this before, and you do get conflicts and personality clashes. The best approach is to observe it from afar. If it gets out of hand, I might point out in front of the whole group that there's a problem between certain people.
Shame them a bit.
Sometimes it works. To be fair, conflicts are rare, but small problems can mount up in that kind of environment. Evening noise, for example. Some people want to go to sleep early and others don't. On occasions, I've had to be the sort of go-between and impose a lights-out time if things start getting out of hand.
What about getting up? Because that's something we're really not keen on holiday.
Well, if we're going into a wildlife park, we might have to be on the road by 6 a.m. But people still ask why they have to get up so early. I've learnt how to do it now. If they're a quick group, I'll get them up at 5. But if they're slow, I won't shout and scream at them. I'll just get them up at 4:30.
Well, perhaps now we should go on to talk about what there is to see in some of those game parks that you have to get up so early for.
Now you'll hear part 4 again.
And now for the holiday programme with Mandy Rice.
Today I'm talking to Don Nicholson, a tour leader who spends 10 months of the year looking after groups of up to 18 tourists in southern Africa. They travel together in the back of a truck, put up their own tents and cook their own food. Welcome to the programme, Don.
Thanks.
This is a holiday with a difference, isn't it? Tell us, first of all, what sort of people go on a camping trip in Africa? And a long one at that. It is a month each trip.
Yes, well, it sounds a sort of student-y thing to do, but in fact the majority of our passengers are people like doctors and lawyers. We do get some students, but they tend to be the ones that are studying something like conservation or wildlife.
And when do they all first meet?
The evening before we set off. They fly in, and I pick them up from the airport, and immediately before we start sorting out places in the truck, we go through what they've brought with them. Amazingly, every now and then we get somebody who genuinely doesn't realise it's a camping tour, so I have to rush out and get them blankets and a sleeping bag.
It must be difficult. A whole group of strangers coming together and then having to live together like that.
Well, it goes surprisingly well. But I always think the first day is critical because it sets the tone for the whole trip. We've had the odd nightmare start where we've got a flat tyre 20 minutes after we set off, or it's dark and pouring with rain and people just can't get their tents up. Once we were making pasta late at night and the cook put in a tin of strawberry jam instead of tomato paste. Those are the bad starts.
Basically, everyone has to take part in the domestic chores, do they?
Yes. The brochure makes it clear that people have to work on a rota system, and they usually do about an hour's work a day. We get a few who don't want to muck in, but more often they're just untidy, and I've got a bit of an eye for that because, well, they might leave a fork lying on the ground, for example, and, OK, it's just a fork, but in a lot of places in Africa you can't get forks, so I'm quite possessive about the equipment.
And do people really get on?
Well, a lot of people have never lived in a tight community situation like this before, and you do get conflicts and personality clashes. The best approach is to observe it from afar. If it gets out of hand, I might point out in front of the whole group that there's a problem between certain people.
Shame them a bit.
Sometimes it works. To be fair, conflicts are rare, but small problems can mount up in that kind of environment. Evening noise, for example. Some people want to go to sleep early and others don't. On occasions, I've had to be the sort of go-between and impose a lights-out time if things start getting out of hand.
What about getting up? Because that's something we're really not keen on holiday.
If we're going into a wildlife park, we might have to be on the road by 6 a.m. But people still ask why they have to get up so early. I've learnt how to do it now. If they're a quick group, I'll get them up at 5. But if they're slow, I won't shout and scream at them. I'll just get them up at 4:30.
Well, perhaps now we should go on to talk about what there is to see in some of those game parks that you have to get up so early for.
That's the end of part 4. There'll now be a pause of 5 minutes for you to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. Be sure to follow the numbering of all the questions. I'll remind you when there is 1 minute left so that you're sure to finish in time. That's the end of the test. Please stop now. Your supervisor will now collect all the question papers and answer sheets.